Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the French Connections Saturday edition. Today's date, the 13th day of August, 2011, of course. My name's Darryl Bradford Smith. Great to be here with you all to have another long discussion here on a lot of subjects. We're going to talk about the rioting. We're going to talk about it spreading. We're going to talk about problem, action, solution kinds of analysis of it, whether or not these people actually orchestrated the original assaults or helped them to be worse, or in fact are just now taking advantage of what happened naturally. I certainly don't believe that the Arab Spring was a natural event. I think some of those things were kicked off by Western influence. That's quite clear that that's what's happening in Syria. So, you know, they would like you to believe these things are spontaneous and organic and homegrown and all that. But when you look at it, you find out they're not. We knew that Libya was set alight by actions of these people. But then they turn around and said the freedom fighters wanted their country to be liberated, which is a bunch of nonsense. Certainly, this goes to benefit the police state apparatchik and the control, especially if the next step is some sort of curfew and martial law structure in some of the cities of Britain. You might find that kind of thing happening in places like Bradford, where you have a high number of Asian in the Asian community, Pakistanis especially, or places like Hull, or places like even parts of Birmingham, which is an industrial city more than London, as London seems to be principally a center for business headquarters and banking and so forth. But Birmingham, and when you get up into Manchester, there's still some manufacturing base there. There's still a lot of kinds of businesses that cater to the country as a whole. And so there's a lot of blue-collar people there. And you find that a lot of immigrants have moved there over the years and tried to find work. Liverpool will be another place that fits that bill. And we saw rioting break out in all of those cities, and it's probably going to reflect the actions that they take the next time this happens. And there will be a next time, because the financial situation is only going to get worse from here, not better. But it's also being transmitted over to the United States. We've had rioting break out and they call it flash mob rioting, which is interesting, because both Britain and America are going after the internet and blaming the internet for this, the ease by which these young people took over city centers and started robbing. Well, it's happening in Philadelphia, and we've got some of it also happening, I think, in Chicago and a couple of other major cities. So anyway, we're going to bring up my returning guest, my friend. He's putting his life through the rigors of Ramadan at the moment, and so we're very grateful to have him here at this juncture, because it's a very difficult process for people in Ramadan. They don't eat or drink anything for the entire daylight hours, and so we're going to try to bring him up and keep his mind off of his stomach. Hey, Muhammad, are you with me?
I am indeed. Good afternoon, Darryl.
It's great to have you here, Muhammad. I you know, I won't talk about steaks or chops or anything like that around.
Yeah. It won't bother me in the slightest.
I'm teasing you know that. Anyway, listen, you know, we see this rioting going on, but today I also want to talk to you about maybe some solutions we can start putting into place. A good friend of mine that I have a lot of faith in said maybe we should start talking about plans we should make after these people are dealt with, because, you know, at some point I think these people are going to have to be taken out of our lives, or, you know, we're all going to end up suffering under the worst yoke of tyranny that we've ever seen in this world. So maybe we need to start talking about processes that could be put in place that exclude these people from our lives and put in new systems. So we could maybe think about that throughout this conversation. But what's your take on these riots and how the people in power are using them to actually put out some draconian stuff, and they're denying any responsibility for marginalizing huge swaths of population?
Well, I mean, we're just looking at the usual hypocrisy, Darryl. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, how they turn around and say, these people must be reined in, look at the damage they're doing, look at what they've done, it's unacceptable. Completely overlooking what they've done in Iraq, overlooking what they've done in Afghanistan, overlooking what they're currently doing in Libya, which is destroying towns and cities and people's lives wholesale.
That's right.
When they do it to other people, it's not a problem. As for them trying to blame a technology or blame this and blame that, you know, I remember the 1980-81 riots here in the UK, Darrell, and, you know, that was before mobile phones could belong to anybody except, you know, the ultra rich, and even they didn't want them because the battery pack was the size of a small briefcase.
Yes.
At that time, the youth managed to take over the streets of Britain and beat the police down without too much difficulty, without that kind of kit. We've seen the Northern Ireland controls before now, where the British Army have even lost control. It depends how angry the mob is. You know, mobs have dethroned kings before now. Without the technology. So I think the technology is a bit of a smokescreen to draw people's attention away from, you know, the mismanagement of the economy, the mismanagement of the financial collapse, the cause of the financial collapse. It's all, everything is about take people away from the real core factor. So, yeah, I would expect them to politically, you know, I mean, for how can they try to blame BlackBerry, Research in Motion, the company? How can they say, oh, this is all because of the BlackBerry mobile phone or Facebook? Completely ignoring the stimulus, the reason that people are out there.
Well, Mohammed, there were also some women and some people that were witnessing, they weren't participants, they witnessed these riots. And I saw a woman do a report, and they didn't repeat the report on the BBC, that said most of the people in her melee were of adult age. They weren't old. I mean, they weren't, you know, they weren't in their 30s, but they were between the ages of 17 and 28. These were some sophisticated people that were doing this that weren't children, but you notice most of the hits are going out against parents and against children. I mean, because now you watch the subsequent reports, and it's all about how bad these kids are, and they're talking children. Many of the participants of this were firmly adults.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, as I explained to you at the time, Dale, I unfortunately came home from work, landed at Croydon at tea time, and the daytime riots had already kicked off here. So I actually walked through the middle of Croydon town centre as the police were trying to lock it down and finding resistance to locking it down. I walked through the middle of it. I walked through the smashed shops I saw what was going on. The gangs which we have in South London are, you know, there's quite a few of them. They are, some of them quite large, like the DSN gang, Don't Say Nothing. They're about 70 or 80 strong. They're mainly engaged in criminality, drug dealing, etc., things like that. When the gangs in Brixton found out that there was a party, shall we say, going on in Croydon late afternoon, they came down in the evening, so that's why it swelled in the evening. It was a lot of gangs that network, that know each other, that know each other's turf, where they can and can't deal off. And what we saw was very sophisticated raids going on. For instance, nearly a mile out of town, not far from where I live down, there's a shop called Richer Sounds, which you can go and look at on the internet. It's a very, very famous company, been around for quite a few decades, specializes in upmarket hi-fi, flat screen TVs, you know, all the great tech. They used to advertise in Private Eye a lot. Anyway, they opened a branch near me. These guys came all the way out from town, smashed the window, bent the shutters up, and emptied the shop out at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So that was not a social statement. That was a very carefully targeted building by criminals. So, yes, you know, there are people using technologies to coordinate that, but I would imagine that's more likely the criminal gangs, and not some of them maybe reaching as old as 40, I would say, Darrell. not just in the 20s, but up to the late 30s even, some of them.
Well, it's interesting, Mohammed, because here's the real upshot of all this, is that they're going to try to make hay of this, the politicians. They're going to try to get the things that they'd like, draconian-wise, as far as locking the country down. They're already talking about, rubber bullets, shooting water cannons, curfews, and then the military on the streets, and this is like prepping everybody for martial law. And now what people need to know in the rest of the world is that Britain is only one tiptoe away from martial law on any given day. I mean, the place is locked down with cameras, and I mean, every single street has a camera pointed at you. I mean, if you pick your nose, you've been seen by six people, six cameras. I mean, the place is really heavily monitored, and so for them to say that the military might get involved and more aggressive policing and knock them on the head kind of approach, that's only a clarion call by the politicians to get the police and military to call martial law.
Well, you'd have to go a long way to get to the state of actually being able to implement martial law in this country. What happened historically, of course, is that we've had the army on the streets, but what they do is they dress them up in police uniforms. A good example of that was during the miners' strike, when all the industrial action was going on in this country and the miners were fighting to save their livelihoods. And I have it on the very good authority from he was a chief constable for Sheffield, that the army were drafted in, handed out police uniforms, and then they charged the miners who were, whatever their pickets and strike duties and whatever they were up to at the time, they charged them. And then the BBC very helpfully portrayed it on the news as the miners attacking the police.
Yeah.
They actually apologised several years later, this is openly documented, for in quotes, inadvertently saying that it was the miners. So, politicians have a long history of, seeing bandwagons and jumping on them. That was a real social cause at the time. Entire communities and lives were destroyed as a result of those changes brought about by Margaret Thatcher. I'm not saying if it's right or wrong, but it's actually what happened. And those people were fighting to save that way of life. The politicians, as usual, misrepresented it, lied about it, and used it for, whatever gain. I mean, we know 9/11. We know full well that these guys pulled the job off themselves, used it to bring about the Patriot Act.
That's right. That's right.
And that's anything but patriotic.
Right.
It's just a clamp down on the US people. It's reached a stage of naked body scanning, which is outrageous. I mean, I don't know how a single person in the United States has actually allowed themselves to become such cattle that they would walk through that and allow these morons to look at them absolutely stark naked, for all intents and purposes, to see if they're carrying something. It's just insane. I would go down there and torch them. I mean, if anybody should be rioting, it should be the American people about this kind of breach. The Constitution of America is just a complete laughing stock now.
Well,
it really is.
This is the point I was trying to make in the intro to this show, is that problem action solution, regardless of whether they helped flame the fires or they just are taking advantage of the events, it doesn't really matter at this point, because unless we come up with actual proof that they did orchestrate some of it, I'm certain that they are going to make a lot of their interested changes in policy, and none of them are going to be in the direction of civil liberties. And in fact, let's talk a little bit here about the underclass, Mohammed, that has been fabricated by political decisions over the last 30 years. I mean, we've marginalized groups of immigrants, allowed unregulated immigration. Now, here's the thing. I don't believe that countries should allow immigrants at levels that they can't absorb fully, and that people should be able to immigrate to a nation only when that country is in a position to help these people become integrated. Because you can't go to another country and start setting up ghettos of marginalized people with completely different cultural backgrounds. Many of them don't learn the language. This is going on in America with Hispanic neighborhoods and so forth. But it's also happening in France here, where there's dialects of languages that most people, the adults, don't even learn French. And this kind of stuff is a perfect kindling for flashpoints. But that's what they want. They like to have those derisions and divisions between cultures and societies. And I think right now they want to flame the fan the fires of black white hatred. They don't want to take any responsibility for the marginalization of the black community, the destruction of the black family, and let's talk a little bit right here about the taxing structure in Britain that actually penalizes married couples and makes it a benefit to be a single parent and having the father out of the home, which is ridiculous. But that same kind of stuff has happened in the United States as well. But do you know that back in the 1950s, Muhammad, the blacks in married were no more likely than white people to be divorced. They had mom and dad at home, you know, and of course they weren't at the same economic level and they didn't have the same opportunities, but they did have nuclear families. That was all eradicated through the 60s into the 70s, and then of course when the crack cocaine hit the streets, it burned everything down. So my point is this, is that this has been long in coming, and I'm telling you it was by policy, not by accident, all of it, across Europe and America.
Oh, yeah, I mean, many people warned about this idea of trying to create... I mean, one of the things we know, they're trying to create these mixed societies, one of the things that we know is that part of the useless eaters documents that were being put out all that time ago by Kissinger and his cronies, they're discussing useless eaters. They were also talking about trying to turn the rest of the world, the Goyim, into a homogeneous single mass, so that the idea was, the social experiment was going to be that they were going to make everybody equal. This was part of the element of the protocols where they talk about trying to destroy the middle class, which is another element of social structure which is being attacked, where we know that people who were doing specialist jobs, I saw a very sad report documentary in America from the sort of Silicon Valley area, where we saw a lot of what were highly qualified, very intelligent people who've been doing some real sharp end tech stuff in that Silicon Valley type area, taking on, you know, jobs in McDonald's, sweeping up, or just menial tasks, things that are not appropriate for them. It's basically you being told now, you know, you go out there, you get your qualification. If you're lucky, you might get a job that you've spent all those years investing in, both time and financially, appropriate to your skills. But if you don't, hey, there's always sweeping up. You can always take on a menial and unskilled task, and you'll have to live with that.
That's happened in my family, Muhammad. I've told you about it. It breaks my heart. My oldest son is an engineer. Mechanical engineer with 7 years experience, and the road works that he was building, and he was in charge of building entire superhighways, and the man on the scene, and he's lost his job, and now he's a bartender, part-time bartender in two places.
Yeah. And see, this is the point, Dal, that's all undoubtedly deliberate. So when we understand that that element is deliberate, it's not a big jump to start looking at this idea. Well, when they were talking about creating homogenous mass of people, that's where they started to bring in people of different ethnic backgrounds and cultures. The big accusation against Muslims is that they don't merge with the rest of society. You know, they're the ones who have a great deal of difficulty fitting in with everybody else, etc., etc., etc. Of course, what it's about is that they really still hold strongly to the Muslim element of their identity. because there's no Britishness in this country anymore, Dal. You don't see people who are really patriotic and wave the flag.
The bowler hats are gone, in other words.
The bowler hats, the Union Jacks, things where, you know, it was a good thing to support, with the exception of maybe England at cricket and England at football, we have very little national pride in this country. But when I was growing up, we used to be proud about our cars, we used to be proud about our industry, we used to be proud about our technologies, our cultural works, our endeavours in all the social sciences, as well, you know, not just you know, making money. We used to be proud of people that were, you know, Olympic swimmers and all the rest of it. Now it's just, you know, well, it might get the headline for a day or two, but there's no national pride in it at all. It's something which they just cannot stoke any longer. And the reason for that is that, you know, being British and having Britishness is more or less outlawed. It's as if you automatically got something wrong with you if you're British and you want to be proud of being British for whatever reason. You know, it really has been marginalised. And then, so you remove away that part of the identity, and then the people that are immigrating into the country, they're trying to make you assimilate with them. So rather than them assimilating to you, it's the idea that you meet them halfway and all become this single group of fungible people that can be swapped in and out of jobs and roles. One of the things that we've had in this country, it's a little bit controversial, but it's absolutely true, Dal, is the effect and impact of this on labour costs. We used to have IT guys in this country that made very, very good money. I mean, I remember people maybe getting salaries of £40,000 to £50,000 working in what was then called DP, data processing, in the late 1980s. You still get a similar salary now. The reason that it's not kept pace is quite simple. We've opened the borders. We've allowed people to gain qualifications, equivalent qualifications in other parts of the world. We've recognised them and then given them the status of skilled migrant in this country, without really thinking about the fact that, you know, we were really undermining, the people didn't realise, the controllers did, but the people didn't realise that bringing these people over, you've got a guy from India and a guy from the UK, and I've, you know, gone through, becomes a full-on Java programmer, he's worth £65,000 to maybe £75,000 a year. There's a guy comes over from India, will do it for £35,000.
And
it's destroying the salary base.
Yeah, well, that's happened, happened across America, and where they couldn't bring the guy in, they've sent the jobs abroad. So this globalization process that everybody has touted and this nonsense about free trade, you know, since the idea of free trade has never been free. It's always to benefit the multinationals, to give them a leg up over the national champions, and that's happened in food, it's happened in manufacture, it's happened in windows, and people manufacture doors, and what they've done is they've gone conglomerate, and they said, you have no right to protect that small guy in your own country. And you've seen the result of it. All of the jobs have been bled out of Britain. All of them have been bled out of the United States. And either in China, India, you know, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, or some of these other places. And the people are just standing there, as you said, sweeping up. And where we are today is the middle class is not only on the ropes, it's virtually dead. We've lost so many people out of the middle class. And here's the process of that loss, Muhammad. You know, when this started really bit in 2007, 2008, and everybody was, you know, running around like the world had ended, and it did. That's when the point of no return was really reached, when we talked about it early on, that they had the Jubilee right then, they had to do a lot of stuff we talked about before Christmas that they needed to do, and if they didn't do those things by Christmas, they were going down a road of no return. Well, we've been down that road now for 3 years, and they've been slowly just turning the world into dust, but during that time, the middle class went and sold possessions to stay in their middle class home. They sold You know, they cut back. They got, you know, got rid of that ski machine and the water jet ski and all that stuff. And then little by slowly over the last 3 years, they've run out of things to sell. They've run out of things to get rid of. And now more of them are losing their jobs, their homes. And there's, the hope is starting to fade now. And, you know, I don't like quoting this guy because I think for the most part he's a coward when it comes to Zionism and the rest of it. His name is Gerald Celente, and I don't know how much of a trends researcher he really is. But let's just go for a minute on what he says. He says, when people lose everything, they lose it. Now, he said it first, so I'm going to give him credit for it. That's why I'm bringing it up. It's absolutely 100% true. The middle class has lost everything, and they're starting to lose it.
Mm.
And when America loses it, a lot of these people, you'll note, whenever we said there's a shooting in America or something and the government starts talking about gun control, gun sales explode. There was one period where it was on the in Congress, they were talking about gun control, and people that sell guns couldn't keep them on the shelves. So what's happened now is these people, the last thing they're going to be selling is their guns. And I just, you know, this is going to end badly if we don't find solutions. Now, I know you and I have talked about a lot of ways we could get out of this, out from under this. First thing we do is get rid of the Fed. Second thing we do is go Jubilee. Third thing we do is start issuing our own currency that is commensurate with the growth rate that we need to return to. I'm not talking about a gold-backed currency either, because most of the gold is held in the hands of criminals. The government in America, according to this, chart I have, has 270,000, no, 270 million ounces of gold in the Fort Knox and underneath the Federal Reserve.
I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I would too. I think it's more like 270 million ounces of tungsten. So the fact is, gold is a nonsense, and it's not a solution, and it's what Ron Paul's pushing, and it's a bad solution to this problem. So, but there are solutions, and the first thing that needs to be done is we need to say to these people, we're not paying you. Second is, we're going to come for you. And we're going to confiscate back the things you've stolen, no matter where you go. The world's too small today for you to hide out anywhere.
Yeah.
And we're going to put the full force and weight of the United States, Britain, and all the countries that join with us against you. And we'll hunt you down in Switzerland or Thailand or wherever you want to go hide out. We're going to find you.
Probably some caves in Afghanistan, huh?
Yeah, some caves. That's right. That's where we'll find them. Tora Bora, right? He'll be hacking on his computer there. Well, anyway, you know, but see, the truth of the matter is we're not at the solution stage yet, but we do need to think as though these people are going to fail, because, frankly, I believe they are. And I think their hubris is so odious and so incredible that they don't even realize they're not winning this. They're not winning this. We are. I'm telling you, the battle of the truth and the battle for the hearts and minds are being lost by these criminals.
I find it interesting that, kind of moving in the direction. One of the guys that was not so mainstream before, but he's got a lot more mainstream traction these days, of course, is Mark Faber.
Yes, yes.
And he's got a different take on the money. And his take on the money is the same as ours, Darrell. You know, I mean, he knows what's really going on. He doesn't go quite as far as we do. But we know from listening to him talk that he really understands what the situation is. And he's mocking them about their printing of money and their quantitative easing and all that kind of stuff. It's interesting, Dal, that a lot of people in the business now, a lot of the guys on the desks, the traders, etc., they go and listen to him now. So there is even an awakening on the shop floor of the financial world, which is, you know, these guys are looking at numbers that just are completely nonsensical and behavior that's nonsensical, and they're looking for some kind of sanity in it. And the one man that seems to understand the picture, as far as they're concerned, and as a result of that, his popularity is making it regularly onto Bloomberg and other places like that now. But really, he's been between the lines, calling for, you know, Jubilee and a completely different way of doing it.
Well, I mean, a Jubilee is a complete write-down, but these people haven't even taken the step of writing down any of this debt, which just means that they were really there to try to hive off and steal. Because there's absolutely no way anybody who's looked at these numbers, and we have for years, knows that this is an unsupportable descent to the bottom, and it will all end very badly. So it makes me wonder, and I, you know, the white papers from Kissinger and Co., and the rest of the Zionist apparatchik would tell you that they want world government anyway. And you know, order out of chaos would also say that when there's blood in the streets, that's when Rothschild says you should be investing anyway.
That's when you buy, yeah.
Yeah.
That's his buy signal.
That's right. Well, see, we're not at the blood in the streets yet, but we're heading in that direction. And world government, and if these guys still have a network that's powerful enough and enough for military and police forces to enforce it, they're going to try to take the mayhem and put order in it and then institute their own special drawing rights globally under the moniker of their criminal network, which they'll name it something, you know, the patriotic money system or some crap. I don't know what they'll name it. But it really doesn't matter what they name it. It's going to be to benefit them, and it'll give them firm control. Because, you know, Serbia was outside there. They had a gold-backed dinar, and we know that not dinar, I don't know if drachma. No, I don't know which ones they had, but they were outside of the money system, and that's when we invaded them. The same thing with Iraq. Same thing with Gaddafi. You know, but not, so they got a threefer out of Gaddafi. They got rid of his private, there was no private bank there. He had this central bank from the government. They're going to steal his water, and they're going to take his oil.
Yeah.
There's a threefer there for them.
Yeah.
A fourfer. They're going to defang anybody that might stand up against Israel. So there's a four benefit thing there, four bagger.
And also they tried to make it look like they're, you know, in the war against tyranny and standing up for the little guy. You know, they're trying to keep it all that as well in the middle of it all. You know, as their reason for doing this. You know, and they like to stand there on TV, these politicians, and get all pompous and self-righteous about how they're not going to allow these people to be oppressed any longer, having backed this guy for decades in the first place. Just like Saddam and all the rest of them, they stand there with their hypocrisy, and I think, you know, people are going to start waking up to this hypocrisy at some point down, and I think that's where it's going to end, because once people realise that it doesn't matter who's there, it's just a puppet show, they lose faith in the whole process. And I think that we're moving towards that. We're getting there slowly but surely. People are beginning to lose faith in everything that they see as the mainstream. They might tout Ron Paul, for instance, as a, hey, we can make this all good again. But, you know, the bottom line is, it's got to be broken before it can be repaired.
No, that's right. But see, we've also got to be mindful of the fact that the most pressure will come to bear when things look the darkest, and that's when they're really going to bring out all their force and all their work and all their things, meaning when everybody's, you know, scratching the ground for food is when they'll release some food. If you do this for us, if you do that for us, they'll come in with the heavy-handed activity at that time. And if successful, we'll end up in a worse situation than, far worse situation than we've ever been, and it'll be tyranny for the rest of our existence. So we've got to start thinking about ways of thwarting the planning stages of these people's actions.
Well, it's interesting because I think, look at the states, the fact that the people over there are armed, they're on a hiding to nothing. They'll never, ever, ever be able to hold the people down. And I think that we've also got this idea that people on their own team, guys on Wall Street, guys in the City of London, guys in financial areas around the world, they've been looking at this for long enough, and you know, they might have had their education where they've been dumbed down into thinking this is how it all works and just get on with it and don't ask questions. But this has gone on for so long now that they are asking questions. I hear it. They are asking questions, and they are saying, you know, this isn't going to be fair on Greece. They're going to sell off all national assets that they've got in order to pay this debt. They're going to be left with nothing, and they say, we feel sorry for the Greek people. I'm hearing this in the financial, coming out of people working in the industry. You know, they're beginning to watch the process. I think when this theft was being conducted in South America and Africa and places further from home, shall we say, Darryl, it didn't come under the spotlight. Also, as the rest of the system was up and running and working, I think people weren't prepared to challenge it. Well, it's got imperfections, but it's, you know, it's working and learning and everything's great. They've now realised, well, hold on a minute, we've had a collapse for 3 years, and this is what's happening on the markets now. The bulls are, they've had their nerves shot to pieces. The slightest bit of bad news and it's just everything collapses immediately, because they realise there's no volume behind any of it, no real sentiment behind any of it, no real trust, and they're asking the bigger questions now, which are, you know, hey, we've been here 3 years, you guys haven't fixed this yet. That's what S&P said when they downgraded the United States rating.
That's right.
They said 3 years,
didn't they? Because there's no inaction.
What are you going to do?
That's right.
Well,
that's right.
You're arguing about what you're going to do. You haven't even got... So, you know, the people are actually asking the question, you know, well, the public know what to do. We're stood here, you know, trying to manage all this money. We don't know what to do. What's going on here? And why does it work like this? You know, people don't have the answers, and they're not looking anywhere near as far down the line as... The French Connection and the regular listeners we've got, they're nowhere near that education level yet. But the questions are forming. And that's where it starts, Darryl.
Well, listen to this one. If you type into Google, a Google search, Arabs did 9/11, you get 8 million hits for it. If you put Israel did 9/11, you get 22 million.
Yep.
So the world does know who did it.
Yeah.
And the world is clear about the Israeli and Jewish participation in all these sicknesses. And there was a guy on Press TV today arguing with a Jewish activist out of London named Gould, this big fat woman anyway. And his name is Mark Dankoff. And he went down the list of things that the Israelis have done since the turn of the last century, 100 years. And he talked about the Stern Gang and Jabotinsky's and about the terrorism and Menachem Begin and the King David Hotel and Laban Affair and the USS Liberty, the USS Cole, 9/11. He went down the list. And this woman comes back, and her comeback was, well, if you could pick out France, you know, in the last, and she says, 1,000 years, France has done some terrible things, too. And so his comeback should have been immediately, lady, I'm talking about 100 years. You're talking about 1,000. You know, and we're talking about a country of 60 million, and you're talking about a country of 4 million.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, where is the apples and the apples and apples in this argument, you knucklehead? But, the, you know, he should have gone into, yeah, you got an earthquake in Haiti, and you're, instead of helping people, you're over there stealing their corneas.
Yeah.
You're ripping livers out of them and stuff. I mean, you know, you're the most disgusting group of slime in the whole planet. I mean...
The quantity of it throughout the centuries for the size and the number of the people is astounding, really. It really is. It beggars belief. You look at what they've got up to. Now, that's why a lot of people have difficulty with the connect, because they just think, you know, it's rather like, you know, saying that the population of Wales held the world to ransom. You know, it just really does take some understanding.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because we a little bit of talking about Santander and HSBC, the two banks that have been, well, Santander since the cocaine trade has exploded, but HSBC made all its money on opium and stuff, you know, and but who benefited from that? We know better, the Sassoon, which was the Rothschilds of the East, piping their money back to the Rothschilds of the West, making their banking structure fan out like an octopus around the world, and then, you know, when the heroin trade kind of trailed off, they stopped pumping the cocaine trade and get that through their Santander arm, and you can't believe this stuff unless you do the homework, but it's all there for people. And, you know, now that with this recent thing, Muhammad, you probably read about it, you know, the American government sending tens of thousands of automatic weapons to drug gangs in Mexico on the border. Now, they're saying we wanted to follow the weapons and see where they went. Tens of thousands of machine guns they gave to drug gangs. Then come to find out, the same drug gang that they sent the weapons to is a drug gang that's been caught through with the CIA, bringing in tons of cocaine to the United States. No different than what they did in Mena, Arkansas, under what's his name there, Clinton. So They just pulled out an old tried and true method of making money for these people and just put it back into operation. That's the other thing that I'm beginning to see here, Muhammad. They don't usually think very much past their old operations. If it worked for them in the past, they seem to like to go right toward that again. But yeah. Since so many people now are hunting down their tricks of the trade, they can't get away with it anymore.
No, their models, which they, to be honest, one of the things that's interesting, Dale, these models have come down the centuries and they've gone back to them and they've worked repeatedly, but they're all predicated on people's ignorance.
Yes.
The fact that people don't understand that they're going on and the people's goodwill, that they, people, you know, naturally like to think the best. They don't like to think that, you know, somebody's actually part of their society, is actually conspiring against them, pretending to be friendly and really hating their guts and all this two-faced stuff in there. You know, people really don't like that. But so it's not easy to accept. And it's interesting, you know, that the Christians were the few that kind of looked at the morality side of it historically, trying to warn people, well, look at what their books say. You know, if they really believe in this, then they're going to behave a particular way. And, you know, they got ridiculed for that. But I think that people have now been able to do the analysis, and that's the bottom line.
Yes.
The work that's gone on the French Connection is objective analysis. It's looking at the facts. It's not being driven emotionally, nor on the grounds of racial prejudice or any of those kinds of things. And anybody that looks at it begins to realize, hey, you know, these facts speak for themselves.
Yep.
You brought them to people's attention, Darrell, but they do speak for themselves.
Well, and you know, even things like that we don't talk about very often, about the medical tyranny that's going on in the world through vaccines and through false sicknesses such as AIDS. AIDS is not a disease. Nobody's ever isolated the antibody to AIDS. Why? Because AIDS is a condition caused by poverty and vaccine use. And anywhere a big swath of vaccines have been instituted in Africa, lo and behold, a few years later, everybody's dropping dead from what they say is AIDS. Well, they've been given a toxin into their body, and they've got bad nutrition, and they don't chelate the stuff out of themselves. And within a couple of years, they've got a wasting disease, an autoimmune disease. And Nancy Banks actually told me something interesting, that these vaccines now are using aborted fetuses, and these aborted fetuses, some of the DNA from the aborted fetuses are making their way into the DNA structure of the vaccine, so that what happens is you put another human being's DNA into your body, and it ends up becoming part of your body. You attack yourself.
Yeah.
Because it's a foreign body to you.
Absolutely.
And so all of a sudden you start having these autoimmune problems, explosion of allergies, which is part and parcel of today's world. And see, I don't know the full mechanics of it, but there's a gal named Jennifer Lake that's been doing a lot of research on that, as well as Nancy Banks and many others. And I got into an argument with, not an argument, but it was a heated discussion with a doctor, Faisal Suleiman, down in South Africa, who has a radio show, and he treats AIDS patients with AZT and the rest of it, which is really, as soon as you're on that stuff, that's a death sentence. And it's making money for the multinational drug companies. And I tried to explain to the guy, I said, you know, a virus is only a virus when it's been isolated. And I said, they haven't done that. So how can you even call this a virus? Well, we'll talk about that later. I said, no, let's talk about it now. He was very unhappy with me. You could hear his voice starting to crackle a little bit, you know. He's like, oh my goodness. But this is okay, because look, this is how people learn. And you know, Thabo Mbeki, to his credit, said these very things when he was president, and boy, did they get rid of him fast.
Mm.
They put him on the first rail out of town, is what they did for him.
Well, it's interesting, but even Gaddafi, pointed out that people that were engaged in the inoculation campaign that come over from France, that I believe Sarkozy's wife was even involved in, that he was saying that the AIDS was being introduced into Libya through that campaign. He actually said that.
Well, there is no AIDS. What he was saying is yes, a wasting disease, and yes, AIDS, immune response disease, not AIDS though, HIV, which is the vaccines actually attack your ability to stay healthy through toxins, which are thimerosal and aluminums and the rest of it, but also with these strands of DNA that are far into your body, and you combine them, and sometimes they've even put in sterilizing agents where women can't have kids after that. All they have is aborted fetuses, and actually got caught doing that. And this is Bill and Melinda Gates spending billions to do this across Africa. And yes, Gaddafi did say that, and I, to his credit,
he may not have understood the biology and the technicality, but he saw that wherever these people went, sickness followed in their wake. You know, and he said it's part. So whatever these people are up to, it's causing death over here.
Well, then another group of French went down there, supposedly an NGO, non-government organization, a charity, I forget the name of it, but they went into to North Africa to save some children. There was no children that needed to be saved. What they went there to do is buy and kidnap children.
Yeah.
And they got caught, and they got arrested.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, so, yeah, and you look back on it, Chloe's something or other was the name of it, and all the leadership of this group were Jewish. So, what they were going to do with those kids? Were they going to harvest organs? Were they going to, what were they going to do? Use them for sex slaves? Who knows what they were going to do with these kids? But
they've done all of those things, unfortunately, Daryl. I mean, it could be, A, B, C, or D, all of the above, We go for option D, all of the above, because unfortunately these aren't slanderous statements. These are observations of fact of what they've actually been caught doing.
That's right.
That's the end of it. It's not a slander. This is we got dates, names, and places. We can quote where these events occurred and what they did. They really did it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you see the stuff going on in Jerusalem right now where they're kicking all the Arabs out and they're building these new housing projects and all the Israelis are in the streets protesting. Now here's the interesting thing. You would think with 300,000 Israelis protesting in the streets that maybe they were protesting about the bad treatment of Palestinians or the fact that their government is murdering other people or their Mossad was backed and Abu Nidal was working for them or whatever. I mean, none of those things are on the placards and signs. What it is that you're charging us too much money and we want more housing.
there's not enough of the settlements.
Well, you see, I mean, here we are, everybody's saying, oh, it's a positive thing, maybe the Israelis are waking up. No, they're not. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about. They're on their own page over there. Now, and I mean, oh boy. you can't make this stuff up. But, the pounding we got.
Also, what it does show, Daryl, is that if they were really concerned about what happened to Rachel Corrie, if they were concerned about what happened to the police peace flotilla, if they were concerned about any of these things, they have got the ability to march on the streets, if they were concerned. But they've managed to brilliantly show us what actually concerns them to the extent that they're prepared to get up. Not against the invasion, the illegal invasion of Iraq or the bombings in Afghanistan or what's going on in Libya. No. The wholesale murder, no, that doesn't bother people. But they're prepared to walk on the streets over whether or not there's enough money in the wallet.
That's right. That's right. Well, and then you start looking at this grid of control, especially over the internet that they've got. Even with the fact that Google is owned by these criminals, even the fact that Yahoo is owned by them, that Facebook's owned by them, that Twitter's owned by them, that Ellison over there with Java over at Oracle owned by Jews, all of, they own the internet. They still can't keep the truth controlled. They can't. They just can't. There's a flow of history working against them that is unstoppable. Now, the only thing that could stop it, Muhammad, is the fact that if people have to become more interested in putting food in their bellies than learning any of the facts, that could be a monkey wrench in our ability to tell the story. But the truth of the matter is, I think the cat is out of the bag. Pandora's box has been opened, and there's too many people now that smelled the rat and done some research, at least. They may not know French Connection level information, and again, we've always kind of been leading edge here. And one of the reasons I do fewer shows now, the story's been told, and I'm trying to assess where, I can keep reinforming the same people unless my numbers grow larger and I get a new listener base. We're really not going to make that much of a difference in the knowledge base of people, because we know almost every negative event that happens in this world is either orchestrated by these people or going to benefit them somehow. But the truth is that now we have to really start looking to solutions here. And there are some people out there that have tried a few of the ideas. One of them, of course, is the Bank of North Dakota has been talked about by a gal that doesn't necessarily understand money that well, but she's made the effort to talk about the Bank of North Dakota, where the interest that's charged, so this is not really, this is as close as I've ever seen the West come to Islamic banking. When you're a member of the bank that you join, you do pay an interest rate, but because you're a member, at the end of the end of that period, that money goes back into the coffers of the state that gives services back to you. So there's no profit to be made. It's a profitless system. You see, now that's not a purely Islamic solution, but it's certainly, if you're the owner and you're getting the benefits of the profits that are coming in directly from whatever you paid in, and it's user friendly and it's actually doing good for the society, then we're talking about something that is viable and is an option for the Christian community possibly.
Indeed. I mean, one of the things which is very Islamic about it, and it's a key word in this, is that it's actually, rather than Islamic, we can think of the term community.
Community.
It's a community-based financial solution.
That's right.
It's owned by the community to benefit the community.
That's right.
Now, one of the things that, when we go back to the days of the useless eaters and the miners' strikes, and the miners were very strong communities back in the day here in the UK, Dal. Margaret Thatcher famously said, "There is no such thing as community." Because obviously with community we have this idea of mutual support, people helping each other out, people being there for each other. But you can't control a people whilst they have mutual support arrangements in place. It's much, much harder. They act as a collective. When people act as a collective, they're much, much stronger than being on their own. So this is something that they've tried to destroy, coming back to this homogenous mass. You know, this was all part of the overall game plan. If people can return back to recognizing neighborliness and neighborhoods, you know, then you start to realize, hey, that there is really a community, and I am part of a community. And let's work as a community. And this is very much everything that in Islam is based on, the idea of there being communities, that people are in communities. It's all geared around that. And that's what I would say is that what we have in common with the North Dakota Bank is that it's a community-based solution to benefit the community, whether it's student loans locally, whether it's local businesses, whether it's the board. You know, the people who are in charge of that company live where that company has its base of operations and its material impact in the world, rather than being remotely owned by some people who spend 3 months in cloisters and 2 months, you know, in the Seychelles and another 4 weeks in on Hollywood Boulevard and, you know, just go floating around the world, not actually living with the consequences of what they do. That's why we have these companies that dig all these poisons out of the world and drop them in people's backyards, because the people that own and the senior management of those companies don't live where they're dropping their muck.
That's exactly right. And you know what? Right now, what I'm watching, Muhammad, and we've talked about this dozens of times, but we're not seeing it. We're seeing some evidence of it in some of the famines that are already breaking out. But you remember in the 1970s, you were a young guy at the time, growing up. On your television screen, you watched the Biafran starvation, you watched the Somali starvation, you watched the Ethiopian famine, you watched, and on our screens, we watched massive hunger. That was a small recession compared to where we're heading now. The 1970s, we had a contraction in our financial system. Now we've got the real deal tsunami, and the people at the bottom are really, really going to suffer through this, and they're already beginning. And frankly, I don't see that much attention being paid to it, but the Americans themselves are going to find themselves starving. There are already people, the numbers of people going to soup kitchens and going to get food handouts has quadrupled in the last 5 years.
It's terrible, terrifying.
And of course, children are the worst victims. Well, the children, you know, it's the fastest growing group of poverty in America are the children.
Of course, because there's, as we've been seeing this in the jobless recovery, there are no jobs, Darryl. So, you know, how on earth are they supposed to make a way through this life when a society has been constructed that's predicated on the idea that people go and get qualified and get a job, and then there is no job at the end of it? You know, the amount of money that they make, they're now beginning to realize that the people who were the underclass when things were going good, you know, why they were having to moonlight and do two or three jobs, is because the amount of money they make at that bottom end, the first element of the homogenous pool, isn't enough to actually live a life.
That's right.
It's enough to exist.
Yeah.
But there's a big difference between existing and living.
There is. But Muhammad, you know, here's the worst part about it. You know, people have tried to use their faith in their nation, their system, their God, even in many cases, all of these things are being tested, and the response that they're getting back from their government and even from their religious groups, and this is in the United States, many of the pastors and the church people in America have not responded to any of this, and you haven't seen them speaking out. Because the laws were changed in America that the ministers, in order to stay tax-free, could not engage in political speech of any kind. Or they would have to give up their 401c3 rating as a non-profit organization. So all these religious people were silenced from talking about what's going on in the country, even if they wanted to, or they would give up their ability to raise money or to be tax-free. So now we don't even have a moral commentary being done by religious people. And then the other half of the Christians in America actually think, you know, Armageddon's a good idea because, you know, they're gonna come down and take flight. All of this stuff is actually working in unison, and it was done intentionally. They needed to silence those moral voices that they had trouble with in the 1960s and 70s, because a lot of the people who spoke out about Vietnam were from religious communities. A lot of people who spoke out about the unfairness of the civil rights movement that were going on were religious people. Martin Luther King was a reverend. So many of the people that have spoken out. So here's the point I'm trying to make. We have come down now to a group of young people that basically play video games. They don't have the brains they were born with in most instances. They're not participating in this fight at all, almost. I mean, the youth of my generation were in the streets almost every day. I mean, in high school, the public high school, I went to a Catholic school, but the public high school that was in my town, Christ, they were having strikes and sit-ins every day.
Yep.
None of that is going on now. None of it.
People were prepared to stand up, and again, this idea that they were a collective, and that, you know, if they made a stand together, they couldn't be beaten, which was, of course, correct. They won so many of the things that they stood for. You know, they managed to exert a pressure backwards. But now that everybody's been fragmented and made to feel that, you know, they're on their own, and that, you know, if you don't do it to somebody else before they do it to you, then you're the one going to be in the gutter next, and everybody's, you know, just get those spiked running shoes on, and it's a sea of bare backs out there, and make a move, you know. It's tragic, really, how they've managed to manipulate people's minds into this position. And I think that, you know, I think one of the problems in moving forward, I think, Darrell, is you know, what kind of structure that's going to be on, because I think, you know, people will have to start recognising each other again as part of this, which is may sound a bit soppy or emotional or whatever, but I think it's a necessary part, because people have to understand how their societies have been slowly but surely pulled apart from beneath their feet, piece by piece by piece. It's a bit like playing kaplunk, you know, one straw, then another, then another, then another, and then all of a sudden you find that all the marbles are gone.
That's right.
You know, it's just one day, there's one straw that when that goes, everything disappears, and they're beginning to realise, you know, we've gone through one change and another and another and another, and it's been coordinated against. There can be no doubt about that.
Well, you know that there's a couple of analogies, an elastic band or a spring. If you pull that spring or that elastic band to its absolute limit, at some point, it doesn't spring back. At some point, the elastic band breaks.
That's right. The elastic limit, it's called.
That's right. It is the elastic limit. And the fact of the matter is, we have reached that elastic limit with money. And every fix that they put in will only buy them days or weeks. And they'll be back into the thick of a crisis almost immediately. And through, I would say, I said this a couple of shows ago with you, they've got a real D-Day problem in October, where a lot of this stuff, and this is October, by the way, Muhammad, is when the fiscal year for the United States, the end of October, is in the can for them. This is when they have no more options left, no more arrows in the quiver, and no more avenues of relief. And I don't see it going past October, just impossible, but we may not go all the way until the end of this month. Who knows? Where do you think we are in this spiraling nightmare?
Well, the another thing which I've been doing a bit more analysis on recently, Dal, to try and find out how this thing is kept going, if you like, we have focused quite a bit on the banks and the financials, all of which have fallen apart, but sat there in the background, strangely enough, there are a lot of corporates who have changed their business model, seen the change in the climate, started moving into different markets or different areas, etc., etc., and have managed to keep going. So some of the corporates actually aren't doing that badly. The real problems are in the financials, and wherever the financials go and take the problems with them. We have seen these problems recently move, for instance, into commodities. Commodities have started getting price inflation. Why? Because the financials started buying into commodities. It's wherever they go, they cause trouble, Dally. They started buying into them to hedge against inflation and to get negatively or zero correlations in their portfolios to make the capital charges go down so that they could actually report better what are known as VAR numbers for capital calculation purposes. They stepped into commodities. Commodities go crazy. You know, I mean, this is and of course, the man who's going to lose out, of course, are these people that we're discussing at the bottom. We've hardly got any money to start with to feed themselves as they push the prices up. But there are some areas of corporate that did suffer back in 2008, but have managed to realign themselves. It's only a small percentage. One company that I'm thinking of that's done incredibly and immensely well is Apple, for instance.
Apple
actually has more cash than the United States government at the moment, which is, when you look at their balance sheet,
I think they have more than Europe and America combined.
Yeah.
Well, but Mohammed, let me ask you a question here. Corporatism and corporate structure has run amok, and we've got companies now like a General Electric worth $100 billion to $150 billion. We've got individuals that have $46 billion in cash in their holdings, and what we've got here is we've allowed these people to buy off our countries and then represent themselves over the country. And so corporatism, as it stands right now, is a failure. And I don't know how to fix that in light of the capitalist views that I hold. However, we've never experienced capitalism in its true form anyway. We've always had a crony structure where the biggest companies, since the beginning of the robber barons of America, or before that, the robber barons of London, that these people have always ended up making the public think they were living in a free market society, but in fact they never were. No. You know, going back to Vanderbilt and Carnegie and Rockefeller and Rothschild, and we can go down the list. But the truth is, we need to do a complete redo of that system. Yeah, and I don't think
we need a proper free market, don't we, Dale? There isn't a proper free market.
Yeah, but corporations of hundreds of billions or 100 billion have no place in that free market. It's not free with that kind of money.
And the point now, you see, that we get into the interesting area, another thing which is prohibited in Islam, is of it hoarding. And that's the point that I was actually going to come to, that whilst it's quite good to see that Apple have been very successful in making popular consumer electronics, and that America is still able to turn it on, shall we say, and produce stuff that the public like and be a global player in the global market, that's all well and good, and I'm very pleased for them. But for them to be in a position where they have more cash than the American government, whilst people are starving, is a moral bankruptcy beyond belief. How Steve Jobs could go to sleep at night...
He's Jewish, that's how he does it. He's a psychopath.
How he could go to sleep at night knowing that he's in charge of $600 to $700 billion in cash, and there are children and elderly people going to sleep in that country hungry. Really, you know, I understand that he wants to keep some money back, and that he's got to blue sky and R&D, and he had it tough, and when he had it tough nobody helped him, and we could all do that, but this is an obscene amount of money. He has the money that, you know, is only slightly bettered by the greatest two Arab sheikhs in the whole of the Arab world. So it's not easy to point fingers at Abu Dhabi and Saudi as morally bankrupt people, whilst in the United States we have exactly the same thing.
Well, but listen, when you come down to it, Mohammed, either these sheikhs that have in Abu Dhabi have been doing business with the criminal Zionists, or they're criminal Zionists in disguise, or they were planted there 100 years ago by the Zionists. Now we got this guy Jobs. He's from the Zionist community. We've got people like Mark Cuban, the guy that owns Dell Computer, Michael Dell. We've got all these people that all Zionist Jews, all billionaires, hundreds of billions. You know, the guy that owns Oracle, what's his name?
Larry Ellison.
Larry Ellison, another Zionist Jew. I mean, we go down the list. 7 out of 10 billionaires in the world are Jews. They're only 0.2% of the world population. And they are psychopaths.
And they're hoarding this money. So there is actually, you know, when it comes to solutions, there is actually enough money out there to make sure that nobody goes to sleep at night hungry, and that, you know, that people can have a good time and have a bit of fun, and, you know, the world could be such a nicer place. But it's with the people who are morally bankrupt. To have such a huge amount of money, you know, and I have nothing against Apple products. I think they're great. I'm very pleased for Apple that they've managed to fight back in the world of technology and come back from the losing corner, and I have nothing but admiration for that. But when you're talking about a man being in control of $600 billion whilst his fellow countrymen are in abject poverty, frightened of what's going to happen, hey, Dal, he could throw away $500 billion. He could throw away $500 billion direct investment into poverty in the United States and still have $150-200 billion left. But, I mean, what's the problem? What is the problem?
Well, the problem is a system that allowed him to get that much money in the first place. The problem is the fact that he works for a group of people who are sociopathic or psychopathic and have absolutely no empathy or sympathy for others. They're morally bankrupt and they're emotionally bankrupt, and these people are always going to be the vultures and vipers of our world, and they are the synagogue of Satan, and they are satanic in their actions. And I don't care whether you believe in God or you don't believe in God. We're just using the metaphor of the sickness in order to make to present a point here. We are in a rethink of the entire structure, whether it be, you know, coming to the companies like Sanofi, Syntelabo, or Pfizer, or Merck, or Bayer, or all of these, you know, companies that have been making, pumping out poisons to put in our bodies, or the Zionist Jewish company Monsanto, or the criminals that the Jews that control Cargill, or on and on, or Mobil, or Royal Dutch. All of these filthy criminals need to be dealt with an iron hand, and we have to confiscate from them the things they've stolen.
Yeah.
And bring it back to this thing being representative of good works in our human society. We can do that, Muhammad. It's going to take a concerted effort, and it's going to take a powerful leadership structure that relies upon a moral turpitude. But I don't see the world coming together until all hell breaks loose. And as you said earlier in the conversation, we have to knock the whole wall down before we can rebuild it.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, that's the way it's going to happen. We have, you know, with the work that you've been doing on the French Connection dial, and what I've been trying to support you through there, is trying to offer to people, before it got too bad, you know, alternative ways of doing it. There was a better way of rebuilding everything. The ultimate game plan, the ultimate corollary of what's going on, is that it's going to have to be rebuilt, because in the long term, no matter what shenanigans they get up to in the short term, in the long term, it's unsustainable, it's destined to collapse. So what we're saying to people is, if that's the case, you know, you can do this the easy way or the hard way, but you will end up doing it.
Yeah,
that's the bottom line.
Well, Muhammad, we've reached the end of this program. This has been a very spirited discussion today, and I'm very grateful that you have made the time in this religious period of Ramadan for the French Connection. But, you know, we all have at least there's some responsibility here to do our best at bringing out these facts to the world, and you've always been there to do that with me, and I appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure to do it, Dal, and it's good that, you know, that we have through the French Connection managed to educate so many people, and to you know, you've successfully called the shots in terms of you know, calling the bluff of the other side, and they've ended up having to put so much material out and not deny it. So it's made the job easier. We have done a considerable amount of work, and I think that, you know, ultimately, you have changed the game through the French Connection. It has changed. There are new rules out there, these new technologies. They can bring whatever rules they want out, you know, Daryl, to try and control this technology. The bottom line is that it was designed to withstand nuclear attack. It's too late.
Too late.
Too late.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the show for today. Not a show, more of an important understanding conversation between Muhammad and myself, and I hope all of you can benefit from it. Please write me if you have any interesting comments or advices for me at smith@iamthewitness.com. But in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, take care of your families. Really, this is a time to start getting closer to the nuclear family that you all hopefully have in your lives, and start bringing positive benefits to everybody by participating in solutions. And send your solutions to me. I'll read them. I may not respond to all your emails because I get a lot of them, but I'll try. If they're important to talk about, I will get back to you on them. Till the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please, take care of yourselves and be well. Bye-bye now.